Pull that lever right there.
This one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, and turn that knob right beside it.
All right, the green one?
Well, yeah, but turn it until the light turns yellow.
Okay.
Okay, are you turning?
All right.
I don't see you turning.
There we go.
You turning?
Yeah.
That's not how you do it, Matt. That's the fun part. Okay, now, one more time. Turn the dial.
Okay.
You ready?
3, 2, and 1.
I think we got this.
Is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, welcome one and all. It is the Grahamian Report. I am your host, Micah Hanks, glad as always to be in pocket with you. As we take to the airwaves for another night of exploration of the uncanny, as we do every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our home here on the darkest corner of the web. Joining me in studio, almost as always, busy guy, the Grahamian Reverend. Good evening, sir.
Good evening to you as well.
Good to have you here. And, of course, all of you guys out there, the fine folks, the resources, as they were in the chat room, and everybody tuning in online via all the various mediums, TuneIn Radio, TalkStream Live, and of course, KGRARadio.com. Boy, we've got a lot to get into tonight. Some interesting comments from one of the world's leading anthropologists on mysterious animals. And I also want to indulge one of my longtime favorites. Reports of people who just go off the grid and pretty much vanish into thin air. We also have to celebrate the life of a leading researcher of the unexplained, and one who applied a lot of science to it. Something weird the Russians might have put in orbit around the Earth, all kinds of stuff. We'll get to all that a little bit later. Oh, and Matt, you know, here it is. We are within a week of the...
We're on the verge.
Yeah. George and Tom and all the guys from coast to coast are arriving this week here in Asheville. I always wondered. Then again, I'm an Asheville local, but I've always wondered why people, from across the world or across the country and who are involved in syndicated radio programs would want to come to a little old town like Asheville and do a live show. But, I mean, all things considered, everybody says the same thing when they get here. My gosh, it's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's a cool town.
It is. Asheville sits in like the base of a little bowl of mountains right here. And, you know, you can go up on the nearest mountain, I guess, which is Town Mountain, and kind of look down and see the entire town, or go up on any rooftop in downtown Asheville and look in every direction and see mountains. And I think it's pretty evident when you spend a little time here why it's called, or why many call it, Land of the Sky. But Asheville, again, you know, I'm from Asheville. I was born and raised here. And although I travel a lot, I think I'll always keep it, if I can, as my home base, just because it's a wonderful place. And yeah, it's a little cooler here in the summer months. A little cooler. It's been hot this summer, let me just say.
Yeah.
And that doesn't always make it fun. So are you excited about George and the guys coming?
Of course. Last time was such a blast that I, you know, it's been 2 years, right? 2 years since we did the last one. So last year I was sitting around wondering, what are we doing with ourselves?
Yeah. You know? It's hard to know what to do with yourself when you haven't got a big event to plan for. Last one, I got to say, listen, I've been to a lot of conferences and things. And of course, you know, I'm used to signing books or you know, meeting and greeting folks, you know, people who listen to the show and the like. But I'm going to tell you, right here in our hometown, the last time that George Norrie came and did an event here and we were a part of that, that was the longest line of fans I've ever seen. That's the most hands I've ever shaken in a single night. That's the most...
Me as well.
That's the most books I've signed.
It's the most books I've signed, and they weren't even my books.
Yeah. I tell you, I mean, it was a hectic event. And so Matt and I were looking online the other night and talking with some friends about the event. And, you know, somebody randomly walked up and said, oh, wow, did you see how much tickets are going for that thing? And I said, yeah, we did. And then we looked online and saw that there are now three seats.
It looks actually like there are a couple more. I did check today. Okay. So the website has updated. There are a couple more, but not many.
Yeah.
And they're all in the upper balcony.
I think Diana Wortham seats 500.
500.
Yeah. So this is going to be a good crowd.
Yeah. I'm still depressed, honestly. Last time there was a young lady there who had on George Norrie shoes. They were clear-heeled shoes with just pictures of George throughout the entire interior of the shoe, and I'm yet to find a pair of those that I can sport this weekend. So,
well, I'll get Tom Danhauser on the phone. He can probably tell us.
All right, cool.
You know, yeah, there was another young lady who came up, and she had bracelets that she'd made that had pictures of me.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was crazy, and I did a video with her because it was just so funny, but... Yeah, it's incredible. And the other thing, too, about it is that there are people who come from all over the country to an event like that. They all come to Asheville for an event. And let's see, some of the folks were from, like, Key West. Some of the folks were from Chicago. Some of the folks were from Seattle.
Yeah, I think I spoke to a couple from Colorado or something.
Yeah.
It was nuts. I expected a lot of people, of course, from the East Coast, specifically, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, that kind of thing. But, yeah, all over the place.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, too, you know, the band's going to be playing yet again. So we've got some great tunes that we have worked out. And a few surprises. I'm not going to say too much. I know a lot of people who listen are going to be there at the event. So I'm not going to say anything about some of the great plans that we have.
It's going to be magical.
It's going to be magical, all right. It might even be a little wacky at times. So yeah. I'd say with as many people showing up, you never know what to expect. Matt, I'll tell you, we lost a couple of luminaries this week. First of all, in the world of music, Aretha Franklin.
Yes, I was very bummed out about that one. I've followed her career, you know, for many years, and truly respected her as a vocalist and
respected
as a
person.
Yeah.
You mean like R-E-S-P-E-C-T?
Exactly.
Her. See what I did? Yeah.
But no, also her work with the civil rights movement. So she was a tremendous woman.
She was one of those people who went far beyond just being an artist and a talented one. I tell you, though, gosh, those early recordings, and actually throughout her career, but I mean, I just specifically the early recordings, her first few hits, you can listen to those, and not only are they as fresh and relevant today, even the themes she was singing about, but she had that incredible control over her voice. I remember one time I was probably like in a you know, like a sports bar someplace, and Respect came on, and I was just listening to the way that she sings that. I'm going, gosh, you know, I mean, I had one of those aha moments where I'm like, no, she is a really good singer.
Yeah, because it's one of those songs you hear a million times and you kind of become numb to it, but there's a point where you rediscover certain things, and Aretha was like that for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, she really was just a trailblazer. She will be missed. In the last couple of years, of course, we've lost some of the great luminaries, I think, of pop music, from David Bowie to Tom Petty to Prince. Aretha's right up there with any of them, and again, like you said, with regard to, you know, her social involvement, she may have even gone above some of the others that we've lost in terms of her effect on society and culture. So she'll certainly be missed. Now, somebody else who has had not only an interesting, how do I want to put this? He was someone who contributed to a lot of different fields of science. He was truly interdisciplinary, but he also had an effect on society and culture in the sense that the man I'm about to talk about, who we lost this week, is one of the true scientific leaders in terms of trying to understand unexplained phenomena and apply science to it rather than simply rule it out and play it down. And that, of course, is Michael Persinger I'm talking about. He was the neuroscientist and, like I said, occasional researcher of esoteric and unexplained topics who was probably best known for his co-creation of what was called the God Helmet. This is an apparatus which stimulated the temporal lobe and allowed the replication of various unexplained phenomena in a laboratory setting. And it was Persinger's contention that if we can replicate unexplained phenomena in a controlled environment, it helps us understand not only what people say that they are experiencing, but also aspects of neurobiology. Now, he graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1967, obtained a master's degree in physiological psychology from the University of Tennessee in 69, and then by 1971, he had obtained his PhD from the University of Manitoba and set the course for a lifelong career in the study of the human brain. His death was confirmed on social media by Laurentian University on Wednesday, where he was a lecturer for a number of years. Now, again, with his studies, for instance, the God Helmet, often what Persinger sought to try and understand was how electromagnetic fields and also things like infrasound could be related to what he called a sensed presence. And this is obviously something that's pretty common, a sensed presence being what he believed was what most people who described ghostly encounters were experiencing. And he thought that everything from electromagnetic fields to infrasound and a variety of other things might actually affect people in an environment and under the right circumstances lead them to think that they have had this sensed presence experience, that they feel a presence in the room with them or someone standing behind them, or they feel a hand touch them, or they hear or they smell something that shouldn't be apparent in the environment. Now, much of his work, according to a statement that Laurentian University put out, focused on commonalities that exist between the sciences and aimed to integrate fundamental concepts from various branches of science. He was a regular contributor to national and international television and radio programs, speaking on topics such as unusual experiences, climate change, religious experiences, and many more. And something that he said, and I want to quote him from an interview he did in 2012 here, he said, "The unknown is everywhere. People have often asked me why I study so many different things. In fact," he said, "science can be destroyed by having the disciplines too thin because there's no integration." He was a, within the sciences, an expert in many different fields, but he was also someone who was, I think as Jason Pentrell would call it, a generalist. You know, someone who understood at least something about a wide array of different disciplines, and he could understand the connections between them as a result of that. But he was something else, too. He was a person who, at times, was quite controversial, not for the things that he studied, but Persinger was known to hand out to his students before classes would begin, at the beginning of the semester, he would have them sign what was called a statement of understanding. And this basically let them know and had them sign off on the fact that he was going to use vulgar language in class and sometimes other kinds of statements or phraseology and things that might make people uncomfortable. And what ended up happening, of course, you know, this has been a thing up there in Canada. We saw the same thing with Jordan Peterson, who ended up becoming an extraordinarily controversial figure in American politics as a result of legislation about speech. Before that all happened, Persinger was having this going on, and they were trying to shut him down and keep him from talking in classes. He actually was barred from lecturing there for a while, and some of the students actually, they didn't only dispute this and speak in his defense, but some of the students actually went so far as to sign off on a lawsuit, okay, to try and reinstate his lectures. So Persinger, he was quite interesting. And, you know, despite all the controversy that surrounded what he did, he was actually voted the province's best lecturer in a TV Ontario contest from 2007. So, I mean, more, I think, enjoyed what he did than they disliked it. But in this era of, you know, again, safe spaces and things like this, trigger warnings, Persinger was someone who kind of stood athwart that idea and said, "Listen, guys, I reserve the right to be able to use certain language." And I think actually I have a quote from him about that. He says, "One of my techniques is to expose people to all types of different words because they influence how you make decisions and how you think." And he did that unapologetically. So it was quite interesting to see his way of teaching and his ideas about things and his open-mindedness towards scientific pursuits, but some of which applied to the unexplained. I want to feature a little audio soundbite here of Persinger talking about the unique interrelationship between electromagnetic fields, the human mind, and the planet Earth. You know, one of the many kinds of things that he would say that would, as we would probably say colloquially, he would blow your mind when he said these kinds of things.
The time it takes for information, any electromagnetic information, and you can calculate yourself, to go from a brain, for example, into the geomagnetic field is about 10 to 20 minutes. In other words, just suppose there are two phases. One that go into the individual brain, represented as synaptic patterns, which when it dies, it's gone. But what about the other information that's been represented elsewhere? And is that physically possible? Absolutely. Does the Earth's magnetic field have the capacity to store that energy? Very clearly. What's the mechanism? That we don't know. But it's going to be like a hologram. Something like a hologram.
Anyway, Persinger was a fascinating individual. I think the first thing that put him on my radar, I should say, wasn't the God helmet. It had been some interest that he had in the electromagnetic effects of unusual lights that appear, natural luminous phenomena in nature. And so Persinger also, from time to time, even weighed in on subjects like UFOs. He was a very interesting guy, and once again, a true luminary that we have lost in recent weeks. One of many. So anyway, moving along, I guess, to some other things happening in the news. Jeremy London, Matt, brought to my attention earlier today something quite novel. And I don't know if you guys have seen this yet. There was a bomb scare recently, okay? And this was associated probably most closely with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. What happened was there was this white styrofoam box that had been attached to what looked like a weather balloon. Did you see it?
Yeah, I did see this.
Yeah, and so the thing lands. A group of, I'm going to read really quickly from NBC 4 out of New York, and they said, mysterious package attached to a bright red parachute set up this bomb scare. They said a group of solar panel employees spotted the box when it floated to the ground at a solar panel field affiliated with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. When the employees approached the package, they discovered a handwritten message attached to the outside of it. NASA Atmospheric Research Instrument, not a bomb, is what the note that was attached to this thing said. That's not all it said. It goes on to say, if found, please call. And, you know, we won't include the name that they include there in the number. But it says, if this lands near the president, we at NASA wish him a great round of golf. That was a joke, right?
Yeah.
Well, needless to say, employees started to get concerned. So they call the police. And they say, we just had a package, I'm not making this up, parachute onto my site, the caller is heard saying in a recording. It's a white styrofoam package, it's making a weird noise. The fact that apparently it said it was not a bomb clued some of the employees in that this, in fact, may be a bomb. And the fact that it referenced the president got them really concerned.
Yeah.
So they bring in a bomb squad, and they're looking at this thing. Of course, what it turns out to be, after the bomb squad had evacuated the area, after everybody's cleared out, and after they go in there to assess the potential danger, no, this thing really was just a part of a NASA experiment. It was a weather balloon with an instrument that measures ozone attached to it. And then somebody had sarcastically written this note thinking, hey, guys, you know, if found, call this number. It's not a bomb. Don't worry. And by the way, if this lands on a golf course where the president's playing, you know, well, so people still weren't quite concerned or they weren't quite convinced that this thing wasn't a bomb. But after a number of minutes, they were able to determine that, in fact, it was not really a bomb. It really did belong to NASA. There was a statement released, okay, because apparently the parachute was launched from a facility at Rutgers University. And this was part of what they described as a Long Island Sound tropospheric ozone study. And they said, in this instance, a summer student employee not affiliated with Rutgers had added the extra text to the note that was included. In a misguided, and I quote this from NASA, a misguided attempt to be lighthearted. The student who appended the note was removed from the project, and we are taking steps to standardize the labeling on these scientific instruments.
Steps to standardize, I like that.
Yeah. A total of 6 weather balloons were launched on Sunday, the police said, and from a variety of locations. But, I mean, I'm reading this story and the way that people reacted to it, and there was a news broadcast on this, where after the broadcast and they reported the news, they said, we're trying to learn more about this. And in fact, we found that, and there are like 90 locations across the United States where weather balloons are launched. And they're launched several days throughout the week. And you find them. I actually think that there was one stuck in a tree across the road from my house. And I could see the thing up there. So they're actually quite common. And one of the weather forecasters on the NBC broadcast had said, you know, she's found no less than 3 of them personally while she's been out enjoying a beautiful day in a field someplace. I mean, she must really know one of those hot zones where weather balloons tend to land, but at least they didn't think it was a UFO this time, huh? Yeah.
With reflecting the light off Venus with swamp gas and all that.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Yeah, I don't know. I tell you, this is one doozy of a story. And this reminded me of something else, too, by the way. Other things that you might see in the sky these days that could be mistaken for UFOs. Weather balloons, an old favorite, a classic. But a better one, I would say, these days are drones. But that's not the only reason that people are concerned about drones. You know, flying in airspace where they shouldn't be and things like that. No, we had that incident recently where in Venezuela there was an attempt, an alleged assassination attempt. That's certainly what it looked like. It just didn't seem like it was carried out very well. But if you watch the footage from that, I mean, that was quite scary. It looked like apparently what the professed assassins were going to try and do was use drones to drop some sort of an explosive, okay, in the middle of this political rally. And so in response to this, a Utah-based company has now said that they are going to be, and they are backed by Boeing and a number of other investors in the aerospace industry, they're going to try and create what they call a good drone with a kind of bad name. They're going to call it the Drone Hunter. And what the Drone Hunter has been designed to do is to be used by agencies within, for instance, the U.S. Department of Defense at major airports or sports stadiums or other such events where there is a concern that people using bad drones, okay, or conventional drones for bad purposes might try and do the same sort of a thing. Okay, now this is what they report. All right, once again, NBC News affiliates say that the Drone Hunter, according to Fortem CEO Timothy Bean, patrols airspace, detects any unwanted objects in the airspace, enemy drones or other robotics, pursues them, and then safely captures them and tows them away to a safe location. So it doesn't just take them down, because naturally, if you got a drone with a bomb attached to it and they just shoot the thing or something, what's going to happen? It's going to fall. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we had similar issues several years ago. I want to say maybe 3 or 4 years ago when, maybe a little bit longer, when drones really began to be used a lot by the military and other branches of the government. When the National Guard got some, they were some decommissioned ones from the military, and they were flying it over civilian airspace in America and had more than a couple fall out of the sky. I mean, this is a common problem. Well, drones hurting people domestically is an issue.
One thing you got to remember about that is, depending on the kind of drone and what the fuel source, again, you know, a lot of like the military drones, they utilize a special kind of a fuel mixture. And I'd been looking, interestingly, for evidence that certain spy planes and things that were allegedly decommissioned, for instance, the SR-71 Blackbird, I was specifically trying to see that aircraft had been decommissioned for a number of years, and yet there were varieties of fuel that it had used that were still in production. And I was like, okay, then what's that all about? And a friend in aerospace pointed out to me, well, you know, certain drones actually use that same fuel additive, so that's probably what it was made for. But that said, conventional or you know, again, consumer-level drones like the one that I own and operate,
yeah,
those are battery-powered. And so you got to be really careful, because if you run out of battery power, typically what the drone is supposed to do is it's going to alert you that it's going to be low on power and that it's going to return to a base, a pre-designated base or launch site that you have designated. Okay, I use one of the DJI Phantom drones.
Yeah.
And that one, I mean, again, the technology on that thing, once again, probably more sophisticated than what sent us to the moon in the 60s. And this thing, I'm telling you, it uplinks to satellite connection and is able to download information about its surroundings, position itself relative to that on the Earth, and it senses when the battery's about to die, rather than falling out of the sky and causing a hazard, that it will override any kind of controls that you try to engage, and it will return to said base and it will land as a safety precaution. But apparently, like you said, that doesn't keep them from falling out of the sky. But again, this is interesting about the Drone Hunter drone, that again, we're probably going to see more and more of this kind of a thing with the concern over what drones can do. Then again, there's also a lot of good with drones. Although I think that where we're seeing this go in the next few years, Matt, is in likelihood it's going to probably be a push toward more of these drones on the civilian level. You know, you're going to have to probably have some kind of specialized certification to be able to fly these things.
And I'm surprised we haven't reached that point already.
We haven't yet. You can still operate a drone. Again, if you want to be hired to operate a drone and use one in some sort of a commercial endeavor or for a business or something like that, you have to have insurance and you have to have certification. Now, you can just be a hobbyist and fly a drone just for fun. But again, I think in a few years, kind of like driver's licenses, we're probably going to be seeing a move toward licensing for all drone operators. Maybe I'll go ahead and look into it. You know, get ahead of the game. Greg Bishop, he is a licensed drone operator, and my good pal Gary Holloway is too. We've had both those fellas on the show. Maybe it's time for me to become a licensed drone operator for hire. Email me or tweet at me at Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this. It is the Gray Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, and I have one question for you. What has Russia put into Earth orbit that has experts concerned? Indeed, U.S. officials are concerned about this, more concerned than we have been about drones in recent segments. So here's what the BBC reports about this. They say a mysterious Russian satellite displaying very abnormal behavior, that makes you feel good, doesn't it, has raised alarm in the U.S., according to a State Department official. Now, we don't know for certain what it is, and there's no way to verify it, but here's what they are saying, that Russia has dismissed comments about what the object, which some have said could be a weapon, they have dismissed comments as, quote, unfounded, slanderous accusations based on suspicions. The question that remains, of course, what is the object that is causing so much concern? Now, apparently, this is what they're saying right now, and there was a spokesperson, Yim Poblete, I believe is how you pronounce her name. Okay. And she says that the satellite's behavior on orbit was inconsistent with anything seen before from on-orbit inspection or space situational awareness capabilities, including other Russian inspection satellite activities. Russian intentions with respect to this satellite are unclear and are obviously a very troubling development. And she also cites recent comments made by the commander of Russia's space forces. See, they've got one, Matt.
I know.
Why don't we have one? And she said that they're adopting, quote, new prototypes of weapons. Ms. Poblete had also said that the U.S. has some serious concerns that Russia was developing anti-satellite weapons. So, again, what is this object? What is going on? We don't know. Everything from a laser microwave weapon to some kind of a surveillance technology has been proposed about this thing.
So I read this article, and I have to admit that, first off, I would like to mention that I feel that BBC is becoming somewhat of an alarmist source for news.
Well, why not, Matt? Everybody else is these days.
I know, right? So I've read several other articles from BBC this week, and they are all just, oh my God, the world is coming to an end. And I read this article, and it's like, well, it's acting weird. So there's this thing that Russia put up in space, and it's acting weird. It doesn't tell you how it's acting, but halfway through the article, immediately jumps to lasers or microwaves. Yeah. You know, it is such a tremendous jump, and it almost seems to incite some sort of panic. In this article, when even we, I use that, we as the government of the United States, claims to not know what this thing is yet.
Yeah. The funny thing about it, again, I guess it wasn't, well, no, actually, there was a statement from the State Department in relation to this thing. But it always concerns me when there is some sort of like a, I guess what you'd call like a preliminary report that appears when there doesn't seem to be any kind of clear indication that a proper threat assessment has been conducted and there aren't military officials that are saying anything but vagaries.
Yeah.
About it, you know,
which is what this story is.
It is a little odd, but yeah. It makes you wonder, though, because again, we hear about their space force. What about ours?
What about the space force? Would you like to know more?
Well, I would like to know more, but you know, a lot of people have been making fun of the idea. They're now insinuating. Los Angeles Times carried an article today. I don't know if you saw this, but they're now insinuating that was no gaffe. That Trump knew exactly what he was doing, and that, in fact, there had been lobbyists from the aerospace industry that had been in his ear for months already at that point, trying to encourage the foundation of a space force.
You know, when he said it, he has his typical fashion in which he says things, and you find them incredulous or just blow them off to a degree, but I've been thinking about the Space Force and looking into it, and it doesn't seem like a crazy idea when you really think about the precipice we are on with technology, as not just a society here in the United States, but on a global scale. It's absolutely rational to think that this is something we are going to need within the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, it is interesting to me that, again, he may not have just one-offed that during a speech and kind of made a passing joke, and then all of a sudden this is a really good idea. Now Pence is trying to find a way to actually institute it. Here's what the LA Times reports. They said the origin of the Space Force wasn't that simple, him just talking about it.
Yeah.
They said the concept had been pushed unsuccessfully since 2016 by a small group of current and former government officials, some with deep financial ties to the aerospace industry, who see creation of the sixth military service as a surefire way to hike Pentagon spending on satellite and other space systems. Now, a few things that come to mind here. With objects, whatever they are, all sensationalism aside, if we don't know what they are and Russia has put them in space and we're trying to learn, I can totally understand why it probably is an extremely legitimate concern and why some people in the aerospace industry would be pushing for a broader military presence in space. And I use that terminology very carefully, and you'll see why here in a moment. But first, I want to get back to this right quickly here from the LA Times. They said the idea of a space force is not a new thing. And this according to Stuart O. Witt, an aerospace executive and a member of the White House's National Space Council Users Advisory Group. The president, he said, just acted on it is what happened. Representative Jim Cooper of Tennessee, one of the early supporters of a separate service, complained that Trump's impromptu endorsement had, quote, hijacked the issue and could vastly inflate the budget process. He said there are many vendors of all types who are excited at the prospect of an explosion of new spending, which was not our goal. And still, when Trump abruptly embraced the idea at Miramar and began promoting it to wild applauses at other rallies, a moribund notion opposed by much of the Pentagon hierarchy and senior members of the Senate became a real possibility. Now, recently, Matt, as you pointed out, they had Neil deGrasse Tyson on, I believe it was Fox Business?
Yeah. And, well, he'd been on several. I think he also appeared on CNN, but I found the Fox Business one to be a little bit better.
Well, I was interested in seeing Tyson going on a Fox News network and commenting on the Space Force, and I think that they expected a certain answer from him, which was not quite the case, and we have audio.
The Space Force is preparing for liftoff. Vice President Mike Pence announcing a new branch of the U.S. military. Joining me now to react is my son's hero, Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's famed astrophysicist and author of the brand new book, Accessory to War. Thank you for joining us. What's your reaction to this? Do you think that this is the right idea, or is it science and space better left in the hands of private hands like Elon Musk and yourself?
Well, the concept of a space force is not new. And plus, as a thing to do, we've done something like this before. You might remember, no, you wouldn't remember, but you might have read that during the Second World War, the Army had a branch of itself called the Army Air Force. And once we learned that this theater of operations, this sphere of operations, had fundamentally different needs, different training, different technologies, different personnel required to operate in that space, if you will, the Air Force then split away from the Army and became its own branch. So this need is in response to the fact that space, in particular cislunar space, that's a sort of new word for many people, that space between Earth and the Moon, to the extent that we conduct business in space, activities in space, we have billions of dollars worth of assets in space. Generally, one of the tasks of the military is not only to fight wars, but to protect your assets. So in that sense, this idea is not completely crazy, and yeah, it's been around for a while.
So what do you think the mission should be? It sounds like you're in favor of it. Do you like the idea? Do you like the way it's being rolled out?
I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I know that there are some military folk in the Air Force who were perfectly content being the umbrella to the U.S. Space Command. So all space activities right now are under the Air Force. And so generally I'm not one to second-guess generals, yeah, but the extent that if we make a Space Force, what I'd like to do is add a couple of things to its portfolio. For example, why don't you check out asteroids to see if one has our name on it and could render us extinct? And don't just tell us that we will become extinct, do something about it. Right now, there is no plan in place anywhere in the world to protect us against killer asteroids or the threat of space debris that could interfere with commerce, interfere with any other kind of operation. And by the way, space has been militarized ever since we sent intercontinental ballistic missiles through it. ICBMs use space to get to their destination. And then we had reconnaissance satellites. So in the service of the military, we've been in space for 50 years, 60 years. And so this would simply be a bureaucratic addition to the U.S. government.
Yeah.
I might think that's odd, given that it's coming under a Republican administration who like to shrink government. That's a point not often discussed. But the fact is, if that can help focus those activities, I don't see a problem with it. But you have to ask, there are other frontiers that are rising up. For example, cyber. Should there be a cyber force? All right. The conduct of war is changing.
Yeah.
And so that could open some conversations that needed to be had okay. over these past decades.
I wish we had more time, sir. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
There you go. Well, so the idea of the Space Force isn't quite as crazy as the media has made it out to be. Many have lobbied for it for years, at least at one time prior to the formation of the U.S. Air Force, back when it was still a division of the Army toward the end of the Second World War. There was something similar that already existed, and many today say that not only is it necessary, but I think, Matt, like you said, now I want to turn it over to you, because yeah. where I think you were going with this was that on the cusp of new technologies, many are like, a Space Force, this is crazy. It might not be that crazy, and it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to put people up there in vehicles in space. What this might detail would be a separate governmental branch which would oversee and maintain and manage aspects of outer space affairs, which would
all... even just defense of our assets in space, our satellites, be those national or private.
Well, that's what I was working around to, is the idea that, again, you know, there may be multiple beneficial services provided by said agency, but ultimately, if we are concerned about things going on in space, you know, a defense capabilities branch of government that is focused on space might really be useful. But here's the other thing, too. Like Neil talked about, he said that at present there is no agency, apart from some NASA studies, that is specifically looking at the potential threat for an asteroid striking Earth. This is a huge problem.
You know, we had this discussion when Oumuamua came through and a number of other times. We've had some close calls here lately.
We've talked about it a lot because, I mean, you and I are interested in astronomy, and we talk about that a lot on this show, but the other thing about it is this, too. As I study archaeology more and more, and we talked about it briefly last week, too, because George Howard was in town, the whole thing about, about the possible impact that occurred 12,700 years ago. I wasn't sold on the whole idea of a cometary impact being what caused the Younger Dryas initially. I was really not sold on that. But as the accumulation of evidence, especially that platinum the platinum anomaly was found there at the Younger Dryas boundary, when I saw that, I was like, okay, maybe there really is a stronger case here. And then I started seeing not only Dr. Chris Moore, who I really respect, reporting on this, and he actually was the lead author of the Nature paper, who I know personally, and Al Goodyear contributed to that too, you know, who the Seven Ages guys and I have spent a lot of time with. Wally Brecker, who is a very respected scientist in the geological sciences and, of course, really throughout the sciences, he has recently endorsed the hypothesis and says we can no longer ignore this. He says this is a obvious reality. Okay, he says, I don't think that this led to the extinction of megafauna. And that's the whole thing, is when people try to tie it to megafaunal extinctions, you got to remember that certain megafaunal species, including mammoths, were still around 3,000 years ago in certain locations. And so while it may not explain all the things that certain people who endorse the theory are saying that it does, I nonetheless see this as being something that science needs to pay a little more attention to. But if it is true that this indeed is what spiked this period of drastic climate change in the Paleo-Indian world of North America and around the globe, really, if indeed that's what's going on right there, it's yet another instance of a object either, if it didn't strike the Earth, it was an airburst and it caused widespread damage and climate change as a result. We had something very similar happen in 1908 with Tunguska and just a few years ago, Chelyabinsk. Okay, over the Urals. And so we have, and then you go further back, okay, the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary, as it is known to geologists, this is what essentially led to the destruction of the dinosaurs, okay? The dinosaurs went extinct as a result of an impact. And there are plenty of other instances where there wasn't as much of a impact on you know, the biodiversity of the planet as a result of it. But there have nonetheless been plenty of large impacts. And if one happened today, civilization as we know it could be so adversely affected that it could change the world literally as we know it.
Yeah. And one of the things that Tyson brings up in that interview that I think not enough people realize or, you know, just talk about in general is the fiscal aspect of it, because typically the Air Force does deal with this kind of stuff. But if they're allocating those funds that should be utilized for some sort of space operations elsewhere, then that's a deficit that's coming up on our the border high above our heads.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's so many things that have to be taken into consideration here. But again, as we're moving into the future, maybe we do need to think seriously about these things. And I was maybe not so surprised to hear Neil deGrasse Tyson's take on this, and I agree with him. If we have threats that are imminent from above, we need to be paying attention to them, earthly or otherwise. All right, more when we return here on the Graylian Report. Speaking of things happening in space, Matt, there was a weird thought that came to mind earlier today. What if we here on Earth were actually prisoners on our planet?
You know, I saw this story and I was immediately drawn to it because of my deep love for Alex Jones. But
yeah, prison planet, right? We could we could live on a prison planet. Well, apart from the connotations of that name, though, I mean, what really got me thinking about this actually had more to do with that old television show, The Prisoner. Are you familiar with it?
You brought that up the other night. I looked it up. I have never seen or heard of this, and I'm going to have to after you brought it up the other night.
Well, you probably have heard of it, and you may not realize it, because there's a song of the same name by Iron Maiden, The Prisoner.
Ah, yes.
It starts off with an audio soundbite. You are the new number six, and all this, and he says, I'm not a number. I'm a free man. And that's exactly what that's from. It's from the opening of that program. Now, it aired back in the 1960s. First in Canada and shortly afterward in the UK, and it was, I think, only like one season. And Patrick McGoohan was the actor who played the role of Number Six, this secret agent who angrily quits his job and then immediately goes to his apartment and is gassed and wakes up in this wonderful little seaside resort town called The Village. And he keeps trying to understand where the village is. He doesn't know how he got there, doesn't know where the village is, so he goes to a shop and he's trying to buy a map. They give him a map, and the map is of the village. He says, I mean, could I get a bigger map or a better one? And they say, well, here's this one. They give him a different map, and it's the same map, but it's got color. And it refers to the mountains, the sea, as they're labeled, the village, the cliffs. You know, everything has a very generic name, and he's like, what is going on here? And basically, there are these interrogators who are led by Number Two, who is under the work, or who is operating on behalf of the mysterious Number One, who we never see, but every now and then a Number Two comes along who's different from the last one, which implies that the Number Two position changes. Whoever it is, Number Two, is always trying to work toward the eventual goal of finding out why Number Six actually quit. And Number Six, on the other hand, is constantly trying to escape from the village. But there's some really interesting commentaries that are provided, because you begin to see sort of a political philosophical narrative emerge, where there is this individualism versus collectivism kind of thing going on there. And Number Six, McGoohan's character, is the individual. And everybody else is basically just complacent and goes along with it. And they're all presumably people who have been put there as, you know, some sort of a punishment or something similar, or interrogation for similar offenses, whatever. Meanwhile, Number Six is trying to figure out, well, is this, which side of the Iron Curtain is this on? You know, I mean, is this a Russian operation? Is this our own, you know, the British government? Are these guys good guys or bad guys? And why do they want to know why I quit? And, you know, he never quite figures that out. But again, thinking about that, I mean, in this circumstance, there are no walls, there are no bars. There are basically the prison, okay,
Otherwise, they're all natural barriers, right?
Well, they're natural barriers, and then there's also enforcement by, I guess, what you might call sort of, to me, I would call them artificial intelligence. It's kind of funny because they're just great big white balloons.
Okay.
And they just kind of roll along, and or they bounce along or skim along the edge of the water. You know, some of the special effects are pretty questionable, but this was the 1960s. But the implication is that these sentries that are just these great big white orbs will just buzz out and they'll just attack somebody if they try to escape, and then they're brought back. And there's also a variety of different Orwellian surveillance technologies, like statues with eyes that light up and look around and stuff, and they surveil everybody on the in the village. And, you know, there are a lot of interesting tropes that emerge, and it was quite influential in terms of science fiction, but I was just compelled by that idea of, well, if you had a prison that had no walls, first of all, would you recognize it as a prison? The enforcement, in addition to all the aforementioned, is also, of course, I guess, the psychological tactics of number two and presumably whoever number one is and whatever their modus operandi may be. It's never really made clear. He's trying to figure this all out, right? Well, I began to wonder about that. It's like, you know, what if we looked at Earth in that same way? Are we prisoners here on planet Earth? And if so, what would imprison us? I mean, you know, if we wanted to take this down a science fiction path, we could say that what if Earth is not only inhabited, but it would be very easy for us to go out and explore space, but there are impediments in place by some, you know, evil alien entity or something like that.
Well, I started to say, if you want to be reductionist about it, you could say we're held prisoner by our own ineptitude or ignorance.
That, you know, again, yeah. Could be, that's an interesting one too. However you want to look at it, though, I began to look for scientific corollaries for a science fiction interpretation. And, you know, there was one, for instance, that Science Fiction, or rather Science Alert wrote, and this was based on one of the Kurt Sagat In a Nutshell videos, which are produced variously, sponsored by different... Have you seen these?
Yeah, I have, and this was one of the things I pulled up earlier today. I love this article, by the way. I'll throw it in the chat room, but this is a great article. Everybody should read it.
Yeah, what's really neat, and the video is even neater, and I have to say that I really love these because they do one on time that I tweeted out earlier today and a variety of others, but Prison Earth is the title of one of the videos. And essentially, the argument that they make in the video is that because your atoms were once part of the dust, the universe expended energy to get to this place, okay, we are essentially not only a part of this energetic system, all right, but we essentially owe an energetic debt to the universe because of that. It took energy to make our planet, and so we need energy to escape it. Now, according to the Science Alert article, they say that sounds weird, but it actually makes sense when you break it down. It's all due to the fact that in our universe, things don't want to change speed or direction, and so to do so, you need to spend some energy. It's also a fact that everything with mass in the universe attracts every other thing with mass, a phenomenon we call gravity. And so around 4.5 billion years ago, gravity convinced trillions and trillions of particles of dust to come together and form our planet, something that cost a significant amount of energy.
This is one of the reasons I really liked this article. There's almost initially I was thinking economic, you know, slant to this article. You get what you pay for. So I found that aspect interesting, but thinking about game theory, I thought about the, you know, a positive sum game instead of a neutral sum game or a negative sum game. A positive sum is that we are getting something in return for our exertion. And thinking about that philosophically, that positive sum game theory is almost a law of the universe from this article. It really, I kind of sat back in my desk chair for a minute and, wow.
Well, I mean, yeah, really, actually, it kind of is, and that's a good point that you make there. The article continues here to say that the effort of planetary formation created a gravity prison trapping us in the process. And they say you can think of it like the gravity well, and they provide an infographic where they say the further down in the well you are, the more energy you need to get out. And so basically, you know, we have this wonderful large planet. The wonderful large planet is big enough and has the resources necessary for it to be not only habitable, but of course, also there is a rich diversity of life on this planet. And so basically, all of the criteria were met such that an island home like Earth could exist. But if we want to ever escape it, we have to overcome the forces of gravity and other cosmic forces which went into effect in order for Earth to exist in the first place. And so we create machines that help us with this. And those are essentially rockets. Rockets have to produce a tremendous amount of thrust to be able to escape Earth's atmosphere. And even then, getting out into space is very difficult. And then what do you do once you got there? Because once you get out there, you're pretty much on your own. I mean, it's really difficult to travel someplace in space with our current technology and then get back. And so in a cosmic sense of things, I was kind of amused but also fascinated to find that, yeah, there is a case to be made for the idea that, yeah, as a result of the cosmic formation of planet, all the criteria that had to be met, not that there was anybody really trying to meet those criteria, or was there? Who knows? But here we are, and there it is. And now we have that constant issue of trying to overcome gravity and the cosmic forces which make Earth habitable in the first place. But it further made me think, Matt, about our ancient ancestry. You know, energy has to be spent going out and searching for food to produce more energy. And, you know, again, in ancient hunter-gatherer societies, typically what we see happen is, and it's kind of interesting because we're similar enough to chimps, you know, basically genetically our closest relative known to exist today. And the chimp is essentially so much like us that some anthropologists would say, rather than make the chimps recognized as people, they would try to identify humans as a variety of chimp, that we are literally just part of the family. Now, what's really neat is certain chimpanzees are very much like us in the sense that the male members of the tribe, you might say, will hunt, and the female members essentially perform tasks which we might liken to, in ancient times, you know, the hunter-gatherer dynamic where women will gather and care for the young while men are the ones who are actually going out and actively hunting. In those societies where the males actually hunt, there is more aggression, especially among the males and also toward females. And the hierarchy in society is a male-dominated society, whereas if you compare that and contrast it with bonobos, where they are herbivorous in all...
Not all instances.
Well, in most instances.
Yeah, most instances.
If you look at the bonobos in contrast with that, though, you have equality between the sexes and, in some instances, a maternal dominance, okay, among them, which is quite interesting. Some have argued that the act of going out and hunting may be what drives this classic idea of this patriarchal formation of society in ancient times. That's all I'm trying to explain. Now, the point is, though, is that hunting, of course, and the search for resources pushes you out, and there's such a tremendous energy expense at doing that, and yet it is required if you are going to be able to find ultimate homeostasis, you might say, with your environment. In other words, everyone is looking for the oasis where life is perfect and everything is plentiful. Plentiful until resources run out or something, you know, naturally occurring in weather or whatever, you know, an impact occurs and that gentle balance is disrupted. And so I kind of thought of it along those lines. And it seems to me that really, despite the great energetic expense, I think that humans are actually trying at all times to explore. And they're going to do it no matter what the energy cost is, and they're going to work their damnedest to get to where the promised land may be. I don't think that there's a promised land in space. If anything, Mars, for instance, is a barren wasteland, and yet we push on to go there. Obviously, something more than finding food and comfort is driving that curiosity, perhaps. Curiosity also drives us. It's driven us since the ancient times. It will continue to do so in the future. We'll be back. It is the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company, as always, on another Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. Glad, as always, to be here in the pocket with you. I'm Micah Hanks, joined by the Graylian Reverend, Remember, folks, he's not a real reverend. He only plays one on the radio. And this, of course, is the Graylian Report. Doing, I guess, what you'd call, as podcasters, gradio. I guess we could say that. And, of course, if you enjoy what you hear on this show, don't forget you can support our work. And it's easy. Just head over to graylianreport.com/X. And there you can sign up for additional weekly content, monthly specials, and all kinds of good stuff. It supports the work that we do, and you get a little something to show for it also. Now, of course, we appreciate all you guys out there and all the support that you show. Don't forget, of course, if you'd like to throw your hat into the ring and become a podcaster like yours truly, maverickpodcasting.org is the website, and you can find the book. It's also available on amazon.com. Because even still, I get a lot of questions from people about podcasting. Everybody wants to do a podcast these days. And I'm very thrilled that it's become the exciting and I think really, in truth, it is also the engaging medium nowadays where more and more people are getting involved. It's something that more and more people can do and do so easily. A lot of great ways to get involved in podcasting, a lot of great services and things. And of course, promotion is easier now than ever before with social media. We've got a Graylian Twitter account, for instance, a Graylian Facebook, but you're on Facebook.
Yeah.
I'm on Facebook.
You're on Facebook?
I'm still on Facebook,
okay.
Believe it or not.
All right.
We thought Cambridge Analytica was enough, but stuff keeps happening. Been a tough year for Facebook. Been a tough year for Elon Musk and Tesla, too. Boy, that poor guy.
Yeah. I think he's a madman, though. I'm beginning to believe that he may be a mad scientist.
Well, here's why the mad scientist archetype exists. Because when you have guys like Elon Musk who work as hard as he does and who does not sleep and who, I have to say, you know who he reminds
me
of?
But he does crazy things. That's not all of it.
Well,
he does some pretty out there stuff.
You know who he reminds me of when he's on Twitter?
Who?
When he gets on Twitter, he will say anything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
He reminds me of our commander-in-chief.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. In this era, that's the thing, is that social media really allows more connectedness. And, you know, people in industry, people in politics can get involved and they can directly engage their audience. And I think I try to run a tight ship with our related properties.
Yeah.
With Graylian Report, and even on my own personal social media accounts, I have to be so careful what I put out there. You know, in this era, you know, and poor Lauren and Jeremy, I don't know how they put up with me.
You better watch it or we're going to, you know, have a test of your mental capacity to see if you can still lead the Graylian.
Yeah.
And then we're
going to
call the SEC in here.
It could get bad, folks. It could get bad. I mean, I'm not far off. See, Musk complains about not sleeping very well. I don't sleep very well. And again, I read this study the other day, in fact, and I wrote an article over at Mysterious Universe about this, about, you know, the different kinds of things that cause sleep problems. But it really was inspired by this study that came out that said that, first of all, it doesn't matter whether you're a baby boomer or a millennial. I mean, across the board, people claim about sleep problems, but those who do say it's essentially the same things. They're worried about something, and most of them are worried about money, finances, you know, the home, their job, whatever. It's all pretty much the same sorts of things. With me, it's not so much that I lay awake at night, oh God, what am I going to do? I'm worried. It's just that my mind is so active that I can't easily turn it off, and I'll wake up in the middle of the night after maybe 2 or 3 hours of really good sleep, and I'll start thinking, that'd be a good idea for an article. I got to write that tomorrow. And then I'll have to resist the urge to want to jump up and write a note down. You know?
Yeah, I do the same thing, except I don't do it. I don't wake up at night. I get up in the morning and my brain starts going immediately. As soon as my feet hit the floor, it is, what do I have to do today? What can I do today? What can I accomplish? What am I not doing today that I should be doing?
Well, you know, once you're to my point, and that all happens, it wakes you up in the middle of the night, you'll have a problem. And I really think it is a problem in a sense, because I think that getting a good night's rest is so important. Then again, though, we've talked about the whole biphasic sleep pattern thing, the second sleep that was referenced throughout antiquity, people actually sleeping in two phases throughout the night, whatever. You know, Matt, don't do that thing, by the way.
I won't do it ever again.
Sorry. Okay. He does this thing, ladies and gents, where he'll look at his phone and he'll go, you need
apologize.
To understand your eyeballs are the size of golf balls, okay? And you literally project, okay, like a movie theater projector, anything that you're seeing, thinking, or doing through your eyeballs. And when I see it, I know. If it's irrelevant, then I don't need to know about it. So don't say it. I didn't say anything, he says. I know what you're thinking. I can read your mind. Hey, I can't read the minds of the fine folks out there. Jeremy London.
I missed this.
Jeremy London just chimed in. He says, what are you two arguing about? Well, Jeremy, if you were listening to the program, you'd know. Hey, listen, I can't read the minds of our listeners, and that's why it's important for them to write into us, info@micahanks.com, info@graylianreport.com. And another means by which people can reach us that I've been meaning to promote, we used to do it a lot, and it is possible to do this. Here is how. You can actually call or text message us on our Google voicemail. We have a Google voicemail, and you can reach us at that number. It's 828-367-7201. One more time, that's 828-367-7201. You can leave a voicemail for the Graylian Report. You can also text us, and we would love to hear from you, see what you guys have to say or what might be on your mind. And Laurie actually sent us a text message via this medium this week, and she said, "Greetings, Mike. I'm a longtime listener, first-time commenter. I just finished the Graylian X podcast from the August 11th episode." She says, "Part of the reason I love fan theories is the creation of entirely new worlds based on fragments of existing ones. The connection of all these worlds does feel a bit like the belief that everything in our universe is connected, however infinitesimally, to everything else. And since we see so much in the microcosm echoed in the macrocosm and vice versa, could the propensity of human nature to make these connections and grab hold of them with such excited fervor be a clue to the fact that everything is, in fact, connected in a way that we haven't been able to identify yet? Many thanks to you and your wonderful podcasts. They're one of the highlights of my life. Laurie L." Well, Laurie, thank you. That's, first of all, a wonderful comment, but and a wonderful compliment, too, there at the end. So could everything be connected? Now, that's an interesting question. I'll tell you this. So Matt and I, we were talking recently about something, and one of our favorite subjects, astrology, came up. But we've talked about this in the past on the show, and again, here's where I rest my case with astrology. Again, it is, best we can tell, by definition, pseudoscience. Okay, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody in terms of the fact that they may feel that they, when they look at astrology and things like this, that they glean some greater importance about their lives and you know, what it means to be a human and, you know, the time that they were born and their sign and, you know, whatever else. But what's really interesting to me, though, is the fact that there are so many things that affect life on Earth. And I can't help but wonder that even if it's only to a small degree, by no means what astrologers might claim, what if indeed orbital bodies in space in our solar system did affect comings and goings and happenings here on Earth? The moon does that. This is, I think, why in ancient cultures, the moon is often associated with fertility and with femininity in general. You know, when I traveled to the temple of Ixchel down there in San Gervasio, actually, is where that was, which is on Cozumel Island, it is the temple of Ixchel, the moon goddess of the Maya. And women, of course, you know, with the period that occurs on a monthly cycle, often aligns in relation to lunar cycles. But there are a lot of other things that happen, too. And listen to this. I was reading from space.com today, and there was an article titled, this is actually an older article from 2007, but it says, "Out of this world hypothesis, cosmic forces control life on Earth." Okay? And they say the rise and fall of species on Earth might be driven in part by the undulating motions of our solar system as it travels through the disk of the Milky Way. 2 years ago, they said, scientists at the University of California, Berkeley found that marine fossil record shows that biodiversity, the number of different species alive on the planet, increases and decreases on a 62-million-year cycle. Okay, at least two of the Earth's great mass extinctions, like the Permian extinction 250 million years ago and the Ordovician extinction about 450 million years ago, correspond with peaks on this cycle, which can't be explained by evolutionary theory. So scientists are looking at this going, okay, what in the world happened? Well, a team of researchers with the University of Kansas came up with an idea, and here's what they said. They said their idea hinges on the fact that, appearances aside, stars are not fixed in space. They actually move around, sometimes rushing headlong through galaxies or approaching close enough to one another for brief cosmic trysts. In particular, our sun moves toward and away from the Milky Way's center and also up and down through the galactic plane. One complete up and down cycle takes 64 million years, which is suspiciously similar to Earth's biodiversity cycle. But they said further that the University of Kentucky researchers independently confirmed the biodiversity cycle and have proposed a novel mechanism by which the sun's galactic travels could be causing it. And they said that the Milky Way itself is being gravitationally pulled toward a massive cluster of galaxies called the Virgo Cluster, located about 50 million light years away. Our solar system has a shockwave around it, and it produces a good quantity of the cosmic rays that hit the Earth. Why shouldn't the galaxy have a shockwave too? This, according to one of the lead authors, Adrian Milot. They said that the galactic bow shock is only present on the north side of the Milky Way's galactic plane because it's the side of the plane facing the Virgo cluster as it moves through space, and it could cause superheated gas and cosmic rays to stream behind it. Well, anyway, they go on to say that the boost in cosmic ray exposure that might result from things like this could have both a direct and indirect effect on Earth's organisms. The radiation could lead to higher rates of genetic mutations in organisms and interfere with their ability to repair DNA damage, potentially leading to diseases like cancer. So, you know, Matt, when you and I talked the other night, I said, I think you'd brought up radiation in the conversation.
Something similar to radiation.
Yeah, some phenomena. And you used radiation as an example then.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I quote you properly in terms of what might explain some perceived effects of things like astrology.
Yeah.
Again, see, I'm not in on astrology by any means, but I'm saying that what if certain observable results that seem to be either cyclical or there seem to be a periodicity to them that astrologers or perhaps people who are catastrophists and they notice the periodicity of these, you know, these extinctions, we notice a phenomena, we haven't identified the cause. What if there are certain things, maybe not all, but certain things underpinning astrology that would actually show us that indeed there are cycles that govern certain things, and this is something that people through, again, what I think is correctly identified as a pseudoscience, nonetheless picked up on because they noticed the patterns, but scientists had not yet identified the cause, and hence they weren't interested in the patterns.
But see, don't you feel that some of this could be kind of confirmation bias? I think,
oh, certainly.
For instance, we talk about the Mercury's in retrograde. You hear that all the time, and of course it gives everybody on the internet and around you, well, Mercury's in retrograde, it gives me license to act like an insufferable human being.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't, because retrograde is not an actual phenomenon. Like, it's not a physical
phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. It's a perceptual phenomenon, not a physical phenomenon. So you being affected by it is all in your head. And that's how I feel about a lot of this, is even if there's something we can't quantify at the current moment, people are looking at this and they hear, well, we see a cyclical nature to this, so maybe it could feed into astrology to some degree. And they use that to their own nonsensical beliefs.
No, that's true. And that's a big part of it, too. You got to be really wary of that. You know, again, we in science try to apply checks for falsehood. We try to falsify the argument. Again, people often get that wrong, that with science, you aren't trying to prove things. You're trying to disprove everything. If you have an idea or a theory, you try and disprove it.
Yeah.
And hence why astrology is not recognized as anything scientific, because in attempts to try, well, I don't know how many attempts really there are anymore. If there were observable phenomena that were clear enough and repeatable enough in terms of observation that they warranted further study, I think maybe scientists would get behind it. And very few, though, they are. There are at least some who have given that some idea. But the point I'm making, again, is that there may be instances in astrology, may not be one of them, but there may be things perceived in the world which we do not understand and which are deemed pseudoscience because we haven't yet found what the explanation is. But one may indeed exist. And again, you know, as we're learning more and more about how things going on in our little galactic sphere affect life here on Earth, things that are, again, not just relatively far away, but which are quite far away from us, the way that they change things that are happening here on Terra Firma and that they influence life on this planet, it's quite fascinating. And as time goes on, we seem to learn more and more about that. But one of the other videos, by the way, that I was watching earlier today with regard to the universe and time was talking about how we live in a time right now. And I tweeted this earlier. So if you follow me on Twitter, at Micah Hanks on Twitter, you can see this. What it was talking about was we live at a time in our universe, okay, where at the rate of expansion of our universe, we can still see distant galaxies, but billions of years from now, people who exist will not be able to see after the rate of expansion. It's not so much the rate, it's just the level of expansion. At that point, there will be so much expansion that people will look out into space and it'll just be dark. They won't see other galaxies, stars, planets, and things like what we see. I mean, again, this is billions of years from now. But it's a novel concept, because if there's still a universe at that point, and if there are still life forms in it, and they look out into the universe and they see things, they won't see the stars and they won't see space like we see it today. The universe will expand and things will get further and further apart. Galaxies will still have relationships gravitationally with one another and they will persist. But, you know, again, as little islands, or we might call that a chain of little islands, you know, island planets. And prisoners, once again, in space with no knowledge of anything beyond themselves, unless there is a great history, billions of years of history worth, that accounts for it.
Resigned to this island Earth.
Well, I mean, whether or not it's humans, because again, by that point, presumably our sun will have burned out and Earth will no longer exist. And if humans still exist at all anywhere, they will have left this planet and gone elsewhere. Or they will have found a way to contain somehow those physical processes that we presume will consume the ever-dying star that we call our sun. Ah, man, but just thinking about, again, time and space on that level, it starts to blow your mind.
It does. I was really enjoying the conversation we were having the other night about it. Is time a construct? And, you know, all of this stuff feeds into one another. And I feel like we could go down the rabbit hole for just days. You know, just KGRA needs to hand it over to us for about a 48-hour period at least, I think.
That's right. Well, but, you know, there's been something else on my mind, though, recently. And I do want to talk about, because, again, when we think about the anthropology, and the politics, and all these things as it relates to humans traveling into space. I mean, astronomy and physics, yes, of course, are the fundamental aspects of, you know, how we look at and what we need to look at with regard to space exploration. But eventually, once we get out there, or if we do ever eventually meet aliens, anthropology and things like this will come into the question just as well. They will come into question, and they will become perhaps preeminent in terms of our relations with other spacefaring civilizations, or just human relations with each other as we enter space, and we have to coexist there just like we do here. I mean, I was looking at something recently, a report today talking about how, you know, astronauts from Canada and Russia, despite them not having good feelings toward each other politically, need to be able to get along in space if they both go to the ISS.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what in the world do anthropologists say about things like this? Well, actually, I want to change gears because when we come back, Lauren found a wonderful audio soundbite from a true pioneer in the field, Jane Goodall. And she is always held rather romantic perspectives about certain cryptozoological subjects. And she recently chimed in on aliens, too, so actually we are going to get to a little of that. But Jane Goodall was asked her thoughts on whether aliens exist, whether the most perhaps famous and peculiar North American mystery hominid exists, and much more. We'll get to that when we return on the Graylian Report. High mountains of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. You know, at some point in the next couple of months, I'm hoping to actually have, I don't want to name him just yet, but a qualified zoologist who has an interest in cryptozoology. I'm hoping to have him on the program. Really excited about the potential for having a conversation with him. I think he's like Jane Goodall and like myself. I mean, we remain hopeful that there are all different kinds of biodiversities out there as yet undiscovered on our planet, but that we haven't got to that point, and we eventually perhaps will, but again, through science and also, I think with, I don't know, I think there has to be, again, that adventurous spirit behind so much of it, too, in terms of getting out there and finding things. But that said, Jane Goodall, all right, who is the founder of the Global Institute, known as the Jane Goodall Institute, and who's also a designated messenger of peace for the United Nations for her work in anthropology. She has long maintained interest in Bigfoot, too, okay? She has lived alongside various different primate species and studied chimpanzees and their behavior. She is, again, someone who has long fascinated me, but it's not just chimpanzees that she's fascinated with. And recently during an interview, she was asked a lot of questions about a lot of other different potential mystery species. And Lauren actually excerpted some of this audio for us so that we can hear what she thinks about Bigfoot. Now, I've heard her talk about this before in the past, But again, it's kind of delightful to hear from Jane Goodall after all these years talking about these subjects, and here's what she had to say.
I wanted to talk to you about something that some would say is fictional, but you would say, hold up, we don't know for certain, and that's Bigfoot.
Everybody talks to me about I'm romantic. I would like Bigfoot to exist. I've met people who swear they've seen Bigfoot. And I think the interesting thing is every single continent, there is an equivalent of Bigfoot or Sasquatch. There's the Yeti, there's the Yari in Australia, there's the Chinese wild man, and on and on and on. And, you know, I've had stories from people who, you have to believe them. So there's something, I don't know what it is. I'm always open-minded.
What about other mythological creatures, like supposedly mythological, like the Loch Ness Monster?
Loch Ness Monster obviously doesn't exist.
Alien beings, do you think we're alone in this universe?
I don't. I think that it doesn't make sense to think we're the only intelligent form of life. This wall that was built between us, we're just the only really intelligent, capable of this, that, and the other. Difference in kind between us and the other animals, that wall is broken down, and the chimps help to break it down.
A fascinating bit of audio right there with Jane Goodall. Again, I've heard her asked about Bigfoot many times in the past. Loch Ness, I'm really not sold on the idea of there being a creature in Loch Ness either. Alien life, I'm like her. I think I'm hopeful that alien life exists out there. I just hope that they're friendly. And, you know, and I hear people say that, you know, if human life on Earth lasts long enough that we aren't destroyed by aliens, and I'm thinking there's so many things in the grand cosmic scheme of things that if they were going to destroy Earth through natural processes and a little bit of chaos peppered into the mix, they could destroy Earth without aliens having to do that, without aliens having to be a part of it. But I'm like Jane Goodall in the sense that if we look at the history of human comings and goings on this planet, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. In fact, this is fascinating. I'd seen an article, just a brief little snippet in Archaeology Magazine, talking about how the latest evidence suggests that Homo erectus probably did utilize watercraft, sailing vessels, and perhaps as far back as 700,000 years ago. I mean, talk about crazy. But, you know, throughout different periods in time, there have been many instances where there have been numerous different species alongside one another on planet Earth. The way I look at something like Sasquatch is, however few in number they might be, that wouldn't be a huge shock to presume that another species similar to us would exist alongside modern humans, because it has been the case many times in the past. The problem with it is there's so little evidence to support it. Many people just take it kind of for granted at face value. And I remember hearing Brian Dunning, a skeptoid, talking about how prior to becoming involved in commentary as a skeptic, that he said, I would have totally just believed that the Patterson-Gimlin footage was real and that Bigfoot was a legitimate possibility. And he's like, now, as a skeptic, I look at the evidence and I'm like, no way, there's no possibility at all. And I'm kind of like, well, but again, that's the problem I have, is that as soon as you begin to prescribe to a certain ideology, now you have completely dismissed an option that seemed very likely to you at one time. Well, but I've educated myself on this point, he or others might say. And looking at the evidence, there's just not enough to support the existence of this creature.
Yeah, definitely. And there is a question I have as it relates to the Sasquatch, is do you think we could reach a point where we could definitively say, no, there's no possible way?
I don't know.
The reason I ask that is because I would think there is a finite amount of space on the planet, and we can observe all of that space, maybe not simultaneously, but there could be a point at which we could reach a conclusion that, okay, we've looked everywhere, it's not here.
Just to bat one back at you,
yeah.
If the creature has existed and it has died out by the time we have completed our full survey of Earth, which obviously hasn't occurred right now, and there's plenty of expansive wilderness out there that if such a creature existed, I think it could probably hide, and I want to tie that in with something else a little different here in a moment. But again, what if by the time we complete said survey, maybe decades from now, a new technology ranging from LIDAR to, you know, drone technology, satellite imagery, all different kinds of things. We have a much clearer image of the Earth. But what if by that time, the last of the last have died out and we have an extinct species? We've proven that there's nothing on Earth now by that time. But again, you know, has the time come and gone that we actually had the window to be able to find these creatures? You know, that would be a question. So again, I say I don't know because I don't know if the creature exists, first and foremost. Second, I don't know how long or how many, if there are any, they will last. And by the time we're able to do what you describe in that thought experiment,
yeah,
I wouldn't know if there would still be any here. So again, with the current information before me, and this is something I wish more skeptics would say, like I'm going to do, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's my best answer.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding your question right. You're asking if a Sasquatch falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, did it make a sound?
I'm not sure where you're going with that.
It's just a joke.
Oh, I see.
Well, us mortals make them from time to time.
Right. Let me, I want to change gears here just for a minute, though, because on that subject of, you know, the remote expanse and things not being fully explored, I got an email from, well, actually, this was a comment on a YouTube video that we put up, and this was, of course, the Dennis Lloyd Martin episode that we did a while back. And a fellow who lives here in the Appalachian Mountains named Tony Stanzel commented on it. Now, the Dennis Martin case, for those who may or may not remember it, this is a case personally that has haunted me for a very long time. And it involves the disappearance in 1969 over Father's Day weekend of a young boy named Dennis Lloyd Martin. He was, I believe, 6.5 years old. He had been trying to play a joke with some other kids on his father and grandfather who he was camping with that weekend, and they were going to run around this big field, Spence Field, and they were going to scare the adults. Well, Dennis ran off in the direction of the Appalachian Trail, vanished, and was never seen again. The family spent the rest of the afternoon looking for the kid. 9 miles away on the same afternoon, a man named Harold Key said, and this is something that is tangent to the Martin story, and I think that, unfortunately, because it is the most sensational aspect, it has been preeminently played up as being the strongest thread to knowing what happened to the kid that day. That may or may not actually be the case. So I want you, in your mind, to try and differentiate this. Just take it for what it is. There was an incident that occurred that same afternoon, 9 miles away at the trailhead of what's called Rowan's Creek, where a man named Harold Key and his family were going on a hike, and they heard a shrill, sickening scream. And then they look up on the ridge and they see what was described as looking like a dark-figured, rough-looking man. Some accounts actually say that he appeared to be wearing coveralls. And this man might have been carrying something over his shoulder, but they didn't get a good look at him. And this man goes running up the side of this mountain. Well, Harold Key reports it to the FBI after it comes to light and the Knoxville News is reporting on the disappearance of Dennis Lloyd Martin that weekend, and he says, I think I might have some information that is relevant to this case. I don't know. And he sits down with Jim Reich, the FBI field agent, and talks about it, and it was later reported in the news, much to the dismay of the Martin family, because they wanted to know, why is this in the news before we heard about it? You know, very scary circumstance. We don't know. Okay, we do not know if that was in any way related to the disappearance of the boy. And I'll just quote Dwight McCarter, who was a park ranger who had been involved in the search for the boy at the time that it happened. He kept a diary while it was going on. And during his diary, in his diary, he actually wrote that, in likelihood to me, the boy has probably gotten disoriented. And when this huge, heavy rainstorm comes in the night that he disappears, he said if the boy was out there and he was lost any place, he probably tried to take shelter. He probably crawled up under a rhododendron thicket or something like that, naturally trying to take shelter. But the temperature got down to in the, like, you know, 40s or 50s that night, even in the summer, because it was so cool up there at that altitude in Cades Cove with all that rain. He said the kid easily could have died of hypothermia. And if he had been trying to take shelter, he would have been in an isolated location where searchers virtually never would have found him. The rain would have made it more difficult for the search dogs to find him. He said that's the most likely explanation. Still is. We don't know if the dark-figured, rough-looking man seen 9 miles away on the same afternoon had anything to do with it. But Dwight McCarter did say in his book on this, Lost, that he published a few years ago, he goes, look, I at least wish that there had been more attention given to the story of the dark-figured man at Rowan's Creek. He says, we don't know if that was connected, but it could have been. And you can't rule out a kidnapping. The Martin family, they were all in on it. They thought that Dennis had been kidnapped. But they thought that it had been a man who they named, Richard French was his name, from Knoxville. They said that they thought that he was holding Dennis hostage and that there was something going on. I don't know what the full story about that was. I don't know if this guy had been some antagonist that William Martin, the dad, had known. Whatever. But so Tony Stanzel comments on this. on our YouTube channel. He writes, "My family is from the Georgia and South Carolina side of the Appalachian Mountains. I've heard all my life that there are wild people in the mountains." He says, "There are people whose families have been there for centuries and they don't want to be part of society, and they know the area very well." He said, "This is a culture that particularly earlier in the 1900s where moonshiners were everywhere, especially during Prohibition, those kind of people have no regard for civilization and they don't like intruders. There are also wild men who are criminals or escaped convicts that have lived in those woods for years and don't want to be found. Some members of my family that have been in law enforcement have told tales about the wild men that live there, and the police know about them, but finding them is impossible." As you can tell, we're not talking about monsters or, you know, Sasquatch or anything like that. These are, as Dwight McCarter said, there were wild men living in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park at that time that the boy went missing. And that's part of the reason the whole thing interested him. But by that, he specifically meant there were men who were living off the grid. And that's what Tony's talking about here. He continues. He said, "Someone familiar with an area like this could get through the woods very quickly and very stealthily." He said, "Apparently the father," he's talking about William Martin, "ran along the Appalachian Trail looking for his son while his dad, Dennis's grandfather, walked to the park ranger's office, which would have been almost 4 hours away." He said, "Anyone that may have gotten him, that is, kidnapped Dennis, easily could have gotten deep into the woods by then. There are caves, there are pits." He said, "It's very sad, but it's definitely a good warning not to go by yourself into a situation where you could be helpless. Whoever lives in those woods and knows you are there before you know of them, of course, knows also how to keep it that way. For many people who grew up near Appalachia in the foothills, you know better than to get too deep in the woods. It's a very different world out there." And I agree with the narrator, and he's referring to us, Matt. "No need to imagine goblins and ghouls. Mankind is capable of doing far more sinister things." So if there was some sort of a kidnapping that occurred, first and foremost, you know, unfortunately, I really mean this too, unfortunately, I am like Jane Goodall. I'm a romantic. I'm hopeful that maybe we will find not only more creatures, but if such a thing as Sasquatch could exist, I'd love to see that. I don't know that that is necessarily a reality, no matter how hopeful I might hope to be. But I'll tell you something that disturbs me is that stories like that of Dennis Martin end up in Bigfoot books, and people mythologize the disappearance. There's been enough time that's passed, and there's been enough distance. And, you know, it's mystery fodder for people who read these stories online.
Well, it's not an uncommon thing. I mean, you know, it doesn't even have to have time passed at this point. With all the television shows on it, what is it, True TV, where it has the, you know, people snapping and, you know, killing their spouses. I mean, it's the murdertainment industry that's come out.
Boy, there's a lot of that in the news lately, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. If it bleeds, it leads, right? Yeah,
which is why I don't look at my phone during the show, because what'll happen is my eyes will pop out of my head and you'll be asking me what I'm looking at. I mean, seriously, though. I'm serious. I can't. It's terrible. But, I mean, with these disappearances like Dennis Martin, you know, my heart always goes back around to the Martin family and thinking how they must have felt about this. And you know, it's a disturbing circumstance. This whole case really bothers me. But again, I mean, the idea that feral people could exist out there, one, I wonder if that doesn't somehow contribute to the broader Bigfoot narrative. And in the other capacity, I definitely think it does, in the sense that people who already believe in the existence of a creature like Bigfoot, they hear a story like that of Dennis Martin and the vagaries associated with it. It's just vague enough. A dark-figured, rough-looking man, there's a shrill scream of something runs up the side of a hill. We don't know what Harold Key actually saw, but really I think that over time the description has probably made it more conducive to belief in it being something other than just a guy who was hiding out there in the woods. But I've encountered that myself.
Well, it's the same thing we were talking about with astrology earlier. It's that, you know, I'm using confirmation bias, but that's not what I'm looking for in this instance. It is almost the tribalism that we get to, even in the stuff we like. You know, if we're Bigfoot people, we're Bigfoot people. You know, you brought up what I was saying the other night. You're an objectivist, you're a postmodernist, you're a Christian, you know, whatever. Well, you're a Bigfootist, or you're a ufologist, or, you know, we have to kind of transcend that a little bit more.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because I've, especially from a national defense perspective, taken interest in UFOs over the years,
yeah,
doesn't necessarily mean that I'm somebody who believes in aliens. And that, if you want to make me angry, if you're a skeptic and you know nothing about what I actually believe, and very little, because again, I don't think that people who are of a skeptical disposition typically say, I'm a believer in this or that. I try to reserve judgment at all times, but when I'm accused of being a person who believes in aliens or believes in this or that, you know, that's as close about as you can come to offending me, because it's antithetical to my thought process on these things to say that I believe or disbelieve in them. I'm interested in the reports and the potential for cultural significance in relation to those kind of things, but that doesn't mean that I believe wholeheartedly in them and I'm going to go write books trying to make the case for them. Although there have been times where with regard to the UFO subject, without saying that I think aliens necessarily, I do strongly believe that there is enough data, and this primarily coming from government organizations, that this would, I think, constitute a strong case that there is something to the phenomena, which is evidence of a technological presence, but it very well could be something of ours, could be, you know, God forbid, an enemy power. I mean, I don't know at this point.
But see, that's the wavelength you're thinking on. And when people inflict that kind of those descriptors on you or anybody else for that matter, I think also shows their limited knowledge of the field they're discussing.
That's true.
Because it is that straight and narrow, because this is the association that has been made in, I mean, for all intents and purposes, pop culture. It is a pop culture association, UFOs and aliens, that exists. And so to only associate it with, you know, the X-Files or something is asinine.
It is. But yeah. And the sad thing is that, you know, I think that, I don't know, I don't want to pick too much on skeptics, because I've got a lot of good friends, and I think that when I say skeptics, people don't know that I mean debunkers and denialists. When I'm talking about those kind of skeptics, good skeptics, Eric Wojciechowski, I want to get him on the show at some point. Bob Laskowitz, you know, we featured an audio soundbite from Ken Fader last week, who I spoke with the Seven Ages guys, loved talking with him. There are good people who are good skeptics. There are also some bad people who I think are debunkers and denialists, and they won't take no for an answer. Either I'm right or you're wrong. That's their whole worldview. And they aren't, I think, truly being scientific toward things. I look at some of these cases and I try to say, look, are there, again, like Persinger tried to do, okay? Or like Jane Goodall remains hopeful of, are there certain phenomena that science simply has not yet explained, and does that warrant scientific investigation of those claims with a renewed focus, perhaps a sharper one, one that technology can aid? And again, whether that's a cryptozoological endeavor or something with regard to UAP, or whether it has to do with claims of sensory experiences or psychic phenomena or those things which some deem paranormal, like Persinger studied from a scientific perspective, had he never tried to understand neurologically or otherwise what was happening with regard to people claiming sense, or sensing a presence, he may not have ever created the haunt, the God helmet, as they called it, and he may never have replicated in the laboratory the effects of many paranormal claims encounters. You know, that's the whole thing. Anyway, we're getting a little off base here. I want to, in the final moments here, just kind of go down a list of things, because Bizarre Beachcombing, or the Beachcombing's Bizarre History blog, Dr. Beachcombing, I like his stuff a lot, and he's done a lot of posts about reports of American wild men from history and things, and I want to read a few of these. He says the first in this series was for Britain and Ireland, and I'm sure he talked about probably some that we've discussed here in the past also. Woodwoses, there was that one account from the King's Record, which was in the section on the wonders, the natural wonders of Ireland. We talk about that case from, I think going back to around the 12 or 1300s. So he talks about some early reports beginning in the 1850s from America. And here are some of the ones that he talks about here. He says, 1851, Greene County, Arkansas, a supernatural sounding man covered in hair runs away from farmers jumping 13 or 14 feet at a time with footprints that measure 13 inches. The sighting reveals that there have been several sightings in the area over the years. Okay, pretty extraordinary sounding report. Where it bears similarity to modern reports is the size of the footprints. This is something that's at least consistent with the modern Sasquatch tropes, you might say. 1853, Florence, Alabama, a man named Goings had been captured, who had lived in a cave in the woods almost naked and who was hunted down by locals. He begged to be left alone, claiming he was doing no harm. 1857, from St. Louis, a man discovered in a lair in the wood. He seemed to have survived on cats. So now we know where all the neighborhood cats had been going. He claimed to be from New York and to have lived in the woods for 36 years. He was about 40 years old when he was captured. He, and Lauren and I both marveled at this, he leapt over the policeman in the court and escaped. Let's see, here's another one. Jackson County, Indiana. A thinly clad man was found in the woods, 1862. For 14 years, he had lived there on roots, herbs, and berries. He died in captivity. I'll skip the next one because they think that it might have been a practical joke. But in 1870 in Utah, some backwoodsmen met a naked 40-year-old man with a vast club, or so the report reads. On following his trail, after one of their horses was killed, they came across a cave with a set of soldiers' buttons that led the rider to think that he is a man lost from Fremont's command of 1846. You can pretty easily tell that a lot of these stories are either probably yarns, or maybe there's some truth to them and they have been sensationalized, or, you know, again, I doubt that if these are the actual newspaper reports that mythology was built onto them there, but, you know, that last one right there definitely bespeaks sort of a legend, almost Rip Van Winkle-esque. 1874, Nashua, Ogle County, Illinois. A very strange, quote-unquote, wild man, this. He comes out at sunset with a pasteboard mask and a yellow and white uniform. He has long gray hair and sometimes walks on all fours like a bear. He can make extraordinary leaps. He stole a roll of carpet from the station master. Again, the leaping louts, Matt. 1878, Tennessee. A wild man, bankrupt shoemaker, had been caught and was being prepared for showbiz.
What's the one? We talked about it forever ago on air, but the guy was like covered in grease and running around the train tracks, accosting people.
Wooly Oliver.
That's the one, yeah.
That was a weird story. You know, again, all these cases, what you see is a person who lives more or less ferally and who runs around of their own accord, often frightening people, often at night. Any number of these stories could be likened to Oily Oliver. Oily Oliver was just a weird story, though, because, again, the story was is that as the couple had been walking along the railroad track, that they saw him like almost up to his eyes down in this vat of oil. Ugh. And then that they saw him running around later that night, and the guy would run around stark naked, covered in oil, which is interesting because that also, Matt, bears a lot of similarity to some of the legends from India of the so-called grease devils.
Yeah, that's, I think, the context we had spoken about him in last time.
And you'll notice that there are a lot of similarities between these legends, because you'll have grease devils, you'll have the what's called Orang Minyak or the Orang Pindak, you know, and then the similarity between some of those stories, the Monkey Man of New Delhi, and its similarity to Spring Hill Jack. Spring Hill Jack being what I call a leaping lout, this character in folklore who could jump over fences and escape capture, just like a lot of these wild men from the 1850s, 60s, and 70s in America. Pretty interesting stuff. Is there a connection? I don't know, but you start seeing those similarities in the mythologies, if nothing else, and that by itself, as we know, is pretty fascinating. Well, another 2 hours has passed. Where did all the time go? It's always great to be able to spend some time with you guys. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, and Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson, Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, Mr. Matthew the Reverend, and I, yours truly, remain your hopeful and friendly neighborhood Graylian, Micah Hanks. We will catch you guys, I hope a few of you, at the George Norrie event this Saturday, and the rest of you guys next week. And in the meantime, as always, stay strange out there.
You've been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.